We're going to begin today in Chicago. Last night, a 19-year-old woman was killed and at least 8 others were injured in shootings throughout the city. Now, that was just Monday night. Those shootings came after the 4th of July weekend, during which more than 80 people were shot and at least 14 people were killed. While most of the violence took place between Chicago residents, there were 5 shootings where the police were involved, including one involving a 14-year-old boy who was shot and killed after allegedly pointing a weapon at a police officer. We wanted to hear more about how the city is responding to this violence. So we've called on Robert Wildebohr. He's the criminal and legal affairs reporter with member station WBEZ in Chicago. Rob, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Also joining us is Charlene Carruthers. She's national coordinator for the Black Youth Project 100. That's a Chicago-based group that works with young people to get them involved in addressing community issues that affect them, including violence and criminal justice. Charlene, welcome to you as well. Thank you for coming as well.
Thank you for having me.
Rob, I'm going to start with you. I'm going to get into the substance of what's happened and what people are saying about what to do about it, but I just wanted to start by asking you, what's the mood there? Does it feel like a crisis?
We get these weekends, unfortunately, more often than we'd like, right? And to be honest, to put it in perspective, we have half as many murders as we did in the 1990s. So while it often feels like it's never been worse than it is today, that's just not true. The perception out there is that it's more violent than it's ever been when you talk to people on the street, but that's just not the case. Nonetheless, I mean, when I was, you know, I've been covering criminal justice here for like 10 years now, and reading through the paper again, you know, it's something I've seen so many times, you know, 82 shot in the course of a weekend. And as someone who's, you know, participated in lots of conversations like this where we're trying to figure out, okay, what's the cause of this? And the numbers are down from last year. Good. Are they going to go down next year? It's just depressing to see those numbers again because it's dozens and dozens of young people driving around the city shooting at other young people. And it is mostly, you know, young people under the age of 35, young men. And it's just, it's hard to fathom, like, how do our young men think this is a good idea? And when faced with that kind of thing, it's like, what do you do?
Let's hear from Charlene here. Charlene, what about you? What are you, I'm asking, we can get into the, what a lot of what Rob was talking about, what people are saying about what to do and so forth. I just want to ask right now, how are you doing? How are you doing? And how are the young people that you're working with, how are they doing?
I live in the Bonneville neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. I was born and raised on the south side of Chicago. And for us, whenever these numbers are reported, it's much bigger than just numbers. Like, there are people, there are families behind these numbers. There are people of all colors behind these numbers, but we know that our community, we have, being the Black community here in Chicago, it's very personal for us and we have a lot at stake. And when we think about the young people who are heavily involved in violence in our communities, we also have to really look at why. Like, what's the root cause of what's happening here? These are young people who don't have access to quality, consistent public education. These are also young people who don't have access to good jobs. And if it's not them, then folks in their families who don't also have access to good jobs. So the problem is it's much bigger. And for us, and for me and the people that I work with, it's another moment of this narrative about Black and brown people, this so-called destroying themselves and so-called destroying the city. And it really pushes a narrative that we don't necessarily know what to do. No. And that's not true.
Well, we'll talk about that. I mean, let me play a clip from Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy. And there was a press conference Monday morning, I believe it was, about the violence. And this is what he says about it.
Okay. It all comes down to these guns. There's too many guns coming in and too little punishment going out. Our officers would not be forced to use their weapons if the offenders were not armed with illegal weapons.
So he goes on to say he thinks there need to be stiffer gun laws and he thinks there need to be more aggressive prosecutions of guns involving, of crimes involving guns. Charlene, I take it you have an opinion about that, so I'll go to you first on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we do know is that there's a lot of profit in the trafficking of guns in the Chicagoland area, and that those who profit guns, who traffic guns, are not actually held accountable. So who's looking at the corporations and the individuals that profit from the trafficking of guns in the city, and who's also accounting for the guns that go missing from the Chicago Police Department? More punishment has never been the answer. What we do know, very factually, there was a study out of Northwestern University. What prevents gun violence? It's good jobs for people. folks who feel like they have a stake in their future and a stake, a secure future and access to supporting themselves and their families. Mm-hmm. What the officer said is really grounded in it's not new, but it's something, it's been done over and over again, and it's not working. And we know if you continue to do something, we punish, it hasn't changed a thing. We have some of the highest incarceration rates in the world, and specifically in the Chicagoland area, the concentration of it. And crime it's not reduced from incarcerating or punishing more people. I take it personally what the police officer
you do.
Said, and I know that that's not going to change things.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the gun violence that took place in Chicago over the 4th of July weekend and actually continued through Monday. 82 people shot over the weekend, 14 fatally. There were yet more people shot since Monday evening, one fatally. My guests are Charlene Carruthers. That's who was speaking just now. She's a community activist who works with young people. Also with us, Robert Wildebor. He's a reporter with member station WBEZ who covers crime and criminal justice issues. So, Rob, dig into this for me, if you would. The Chicago Sun-Times, as you know, has a web-based publication that seeks to document every single homicide in the city year by year. And as Charlene said, make sure that people know that these are people and pictures of each of them. But the department says that gun-related homicides are down this year compared with numbers at the same time, but that the overall number of shooting incidents has increased. So, Rob, do you just want to amplify that for a couple of minutes? And how should we look at these numbers?
Well, the way that the Chicago Police Department is counting these is shooting incidents, because they say, you can count homicides, but a more accurate indicator of where the crime is at is shooting incidents. If you have a shooting incident but no homicide victim, maybe it's because the bullet was 2 inches over and missed an artery or an organ or something like that. So they're counting the shootings. We're actually up in shootings compared to last year. We're down in homicides compared to last year. And in terms of the homicide numbers, again, we were lower last year than we have been in four decades. As far as kind of the city's take on this and what the police superintendent said there in the clip you played, he says, you know, it all comes down to these gun laws and these gun trafficking. And we know that's just not true. I mean, if that was true, we wouldn't be engaged in all these policing efforts, right? And if you to Charlene's point, you know, as to whether, you know, this is about jobs and violence, she said, you know, access to jobs is important for reducing violence. And I think that's probably true, and we all think it's good for people to have good jobs, right? And none of us like the issues of poverty. Nonetheless, if you look at New York City, there's all sorts of poverty there. There's all sorts of dysfunction, and yet they've been able to bring their homicide numbers down 80%, more than 80% since the early 90s. And the criminologists and researchers that I've talked to have said this is about policing. And so they were able to bring down homicides without addressing these larger factors that are important and we want to address, but they were able to bring down homicides without, you know, giving everyone a job, just in terms of policing and particularly focusing police resources in high crime areas.
In a written statement, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel said the number of shootings and murders that took place over the holiday weekend is simply unacceptable and points out that we still have work to do. The solution does not just include policing. We also have to give our young people alternative to the street. So, Charlene, we have a couple of minutes left. Tell us, what is the mayor saying, anything that seems to resonate with the young people that you work with? And are there any, I guess, activities going on that seem to resonate with you?
So I'm a firm believer that rhetoric has to turn into action, and the actions that you engage in speak much louder than the words that you say. And of course, as Robert mentioned, jobs are one part of the equation in getting at these systemic issues. As we all very well know, over 50 public schools were closed in Chicago under the mayor's leadership. And of course, not just the mayor, but also the leadership of aldermen in the city as well. And those factors of young people seeing that their education isn't valued, seeing that they have limited opportunities beyond high school, which is, of course, a bigger issue than just what the mayor of the city of Chicago does. But all of these things, they're all interrelated.
Let me ask you about what Rob said, though. What about what he said, that there are other cities that have similar challenges and are not experiencing this right now? Why do you think this happened this weekend the way it did? Why do you think this happened?
So I think that it's a combination of the long-held segregation policies in Chicago, our housing policies, displacement of people, the closing of our schools, and overall feeling that folks' individual lives are not valued by those who we pay and those who we elect to represent us in office. And it's not this weekend, as Robert mentioned, this weekend has things like this have happened before. So it's not necessarily something brand new. Actually, it's not brand new at all.
Okay.
And just because it happens in other cities, like, I'm primarily concerned with what's happening here in Chicago and what we're doing about it to address the structural problems that exist and not exacerbating them by creating more a larger carceral state and more punishment for people when we know that that hasn't worked in Chicago. And if I could say one thing more
about New York City. Very briefly, if you would. Yeah.
One more thing about New York City. I've also lived in New York City. And we can't glance over the fact that how stop and frisk policies play into policing in New York City, and also other improvements that have been made in the city. So those things don't live in silos. And even in Chicago, we have our own form of stop and frisk when they come.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there for now. Sorry, Charlene. Thanks. Time is the one thing they're not making more of. We appreciate it. Charlene Carruthers is the national coordinator for Chicago's Black Youth Project 100. She was with us by phone from Chicago, along with Robert Wilde, who's the criminal and legal affairs reporter for WBEZ. Thank you both so much for speaking with us. We appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You too.
For the past few years, we've been following controversies over the new voter ID laws that a number of states have adopted, usually setting new requirements for identification that voters need to produce in order to vote. Republicans have spearheaded many of these changes, saying that they are needed to combat fraud. Most often, challenges have come from racial minorities who say that the requirements pose a disproportionate burden on them or are intended to discourage them from voting. But now there is a new challenge. In a case before the U.S. District Court in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, college students are claiming that that state's voter ID law, adopted last year, discriminates against young voters. These laws don't go into effect until 2016, but a victory for the students and their partners in the case could put other aspects of the law on hold. We wanted to know more about this, so we're joined now by New York Times reporter Matt Apuzzo, who's been covering this story. Matt, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Great to be back.
So what parts of North Carolina's voter ID law are these students challenging?
So you really have to look at it on two prongs, right? So there's the one aspect, which is the Department of Justice, the NAACP, on all these civil rights groups were challenging the whole law, the voter ID component, also the elimination of same-day registration, the reduction in times and early voting. So the law in its totality is also under fire. But separately, the students have joined the lawsuit, and they've said this specifically discriminates against young voters under the 26th Amendment. Now, if you're like me, I'm a legal guy, but 26th Amendment, what the heck is the 26th Amendment? 26th Amendment is the amendment that lowered the voting age to 18. But it didn't say the voting age shall be 18. It said nobody shall make any laws that would restrict the right of anybody who's attained the age of 18 to vote. So it's written very much like an anti-discrimination law. So if this works, this would really open up a new front in the fight over sort of voting access laws.
Is that what makes this different from the other challenges to the law?
Right. So they've sort of, the court, in the name of trying to make things all, you know, more convenient, they've kind of added all these cases into one. So it's all one case now. But what's unique about what the students are asking is there's never been a case quite like this that's claimed the 26th Amendment is basically on par with the 14th Amendment, which is obviously a racial discrimination.
Now, how did this get to the courts? I mean, you know, sometimes plaintiffs are recruited for cases. I mean, that's not a secret that people sometimes look around for people who are well positioned to make an argument. How did this case come about? Or did these students try to vote and then were turned away, or were their student IDs rejected? Or how did this come about?
Well, since the law on the ID portion hasn't taken effect, nobody's been turned away from voting at this point. You know, they're really challenging it to try to keep it from taking effect. I think it's pretty clear that the plaintiffs here, if not recruited, are clearly of like minds. I mean, we're talking about the president and vice president of various, you know, student Democratic groups, as in student Democrats, not Democratic.
Mm-hmm. Well, are they mostly Democrats, though, to that end, though? I mean, what about Republican students? We know that there were young Republican groups on these campuses, you know, as well.
Sure.
We know that younger people have tended to vote Democratic in recent elections in North Carolina.
It's not just that they've tended to. Uh-huh. I mean, for the last two elections, I mean, it's been nearly 2-1 in the 18 to 29 age group category. It's so overwhelming in North Carolina for that age group that in 2008, Obama carried the state. And he didn't carry any other age groups other than the young voters, but they turned out in such huge numbers and so overwhelmingly for him, it didn't matter that Obama lost every single other age group. He just won among young voters. So, I mean, it really speaks to the potency that this demographic has, both obviously in North Carolina, but certainly nationwide.
What about the other side of the argument, though? As we mentioned, that the driver of many of these changes have been Republicans in a number of states where Republicans either hold the governor's office or hold the legislature, and their argument has been that this is necessary to counter fraud. Is there any evidence that voter fraud has affected recent elections, apart from the, you know, anecdotal evidence? Is there any evidence that it has?
Well, there's no evidence of kind of this widespread sort of in-person voting fraud that people are most afraid of. But what there is a lot of evidence is that the voting rolls are just a mess. I mean, think about it. We've all moved in our lives. I moved from Connecticut to D.C. When I got here, I registered to vote. It never even kind of occurred to me to change, to cancel my registration in Connecticut. I have no idea if I'm still registered in Connecticut. You know, we've all had family members pass on, and as you're taking care of, you know, you're getting their affairs in order, does anybody think to alert the state that somebody's died? I think we all kind of assume, well, the government will catch up, right? I mean, the records will catch up, and usually they do, but lots of times they don't. So there are lots of dead people on the voter rolls nationwide. I think everybody would agree that's a problem. Now, does that mean that large numbers of people are voting in the name of dead people? Well, the Justice Department under George Bush looked into that. A number of groups have looked into that. We haven't found any evidence of kind of this organized widespread fraud. But the argument is, well, why allow that to happen when you can just have an ID requirement?
Where does this case go from here? Talk about that, if you would. What happens now?
So right now, like literally right now, all this week, we are going to have there are hearings going on in federal court in North Carolina. And what these groups want to do, including the Justice Department, they are trying to ask a judge to put the law on hold. So stop it from taking effect for the 2016 election. So it's the voter ID component and maybe everything else too. And if a judge agrees to do that, then obviously it would be on hold until some determination is made probably next year about whether or not it's constitutional or not. But so right now what the fight is whether to temporarily put it on hold. And then probably in 2015 there'll actually be a case, a trial, which asks a judge to make a final ruling on whether it's unconstitutional or not. And then the appeals from there.
I know reporters hate it when people ask them to predict, so I'm not going to ask you to predict, but I am going to ask you to say about, has there been any precedent for people challenging voter registration strategies based on age, based on the 26th Amendment, as opposed to on racial grounds previously?
Sure.
Do we know?
So there's one Supreme Court precedent for this. I mean, this is not a often used amendment. Courts have pretty routinely held that that cities can't say, "We're just not going to register students because we don't consider you to be permanent resident. We don't consider you to be residents." You can't say that, and obviously you can't say we are just not going to register African Americans. But courts have been pretty have a long history of ruling that. There are degrees of discrimination when it comes to racial discrimination, that it doesn't have to be outright, we won't register African Americans, that, you know, it's unconstitutional to have, you know, tests, or it's unconstitutional to have degrees of discrimination. We never have really decided, there's been no case law on whether there are degrees of discrimination for college kids, for young voters. So even if, what's interesting here is, even if the students lose, they kind of win as long as a judge says, I buy your argument that you can make a claim here, but you failed. Even if you failed to make it, just if he buys the argument that young voters can make a discrimination claim,
in the same way minorities can make a discrimination claim under the 14th Amendment. That, I think, would probably be a win in the eyes of a lot of Democratic and sort of voter advocacy groups.
That's Matt Apuzzo. He's a reporter for The New York Times. He's been covering the legal challenge to voter ID laws in North Carolina. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Now it's time for our Money Coach conversation. That's the part of the program where we talk about the economy and personal finance. If you have a child moving into a new apartment or going off to college, you might be looking to downsize your home, move into a smaller place. But before you start celebrating your cute new townhouse, you might think about how are you going to get rid of that old couch or grandma's good china? It turns out that the antiques and secondhand furniture market is on the decline, and many people are finding themselves stuck with unwanted items. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called Kate Grondin. She is the founder of Home Transition Resource. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
So why is it becoming more difficult to get rid of used furniture and other items?
I think people are just sort of living differently. They're not wanting their parents' used furniture. Our parents bought things that were going to last them a long time. And when they're trying to get rid of it, the children just don't want it. I'm working with a client right now, for instance, who's cleaning out her home. And she has three children. They've gone around and identified some of the things that they want. And when they found out how much it was going to cost to ship the items to their new, to their home, they reconsidered. So it wasn't worth it for them to keep some of those items.
What kinds of items is it that, what kinds of items do, are people, I don't want to say turning their noses up. That seems so harsh. How about choosing not to acquire these days that might have been highly sought after in the past?
So there are a few things that are difficult to get rid of. And one of the things is like a dining room set, a dining room table, a hutch, a buffet. Those things are so difficult to get rid of because nowadays people have kitchens with large islands where people gather. Families eat around the island, and the dining room table is just sort of in a room not used. So people are not inclined to purchase that, you know, formal dining room set that used to be so popular. That's one of the items that we're faced with that are just very difficult to get rid of. People are getting pennies on the dollar, and it's heartbreaking. But that's what's happening today.
And I'm told that armoires and those big bookcase things that people would put big televisions in because guess
exactly.
What? People hang televisions on the wall these days, right?
That's right. You don't need to hide your TV anymore. And I have a client also who has an armoire that's been on Craigslist for a year. And he paid thousands of dollars for it. But honestly, I think we're going to probably end up donating that piece. How difficult it is.
Are there items that are still selling that people still are looking for and will pay money for?
Well, you know, yard equipment, for example, is popular. Some rugs are popular. We can get rid of those.
Wait, yard equipment? A lawnmower?
Yard equipment. Yes, surprisingly. you know, if you're cleaning out your garage and you have a nice riding lawnmower, that's going to sell. If you have, you know, washer and dryer, those types of things sell. Furniture is just difficult. It needs to be a unique piece. It needs to be light brown furniture, doesn't sell. And it needs to be something that can fit into someone's decor, which nowadays people go to the internet and to magazines for inspiration. And so it needs to be a unique piece. So we're having a difficult time helping people identify resources for their used furniture.
What is the hardest part of all this? Is it having to discuss with clients that people don't want something that they may cherish, that they have a lot of memories wrapped up in? Is that what's the hardest part of it for you? Have you had people cry?
Yeah, you said it. Absolutely. It's so heartbreaking. But honestly, the managing the expectations is probably the hardest part. If you can get a client to understand that their furniture isn't worth what they paid for it, and it's not even worth a quarter of what they paid for it, and manage those expectations, you're going to have a more positive outcome than, you know, someone who is demanding a certain price or expects a certain price and holds on for that price. It's not going to happen. So I think you're right. Managing the expectations is extremely important.
Well, you know what? It's kind of hard, though, when you still hear about people being ill-housed or having families, for example, who've had a fire, or families who have been, you know, forced into homelessness, for example, and don't, you know, have adequate furniture to live on. It just seems that there's something wrong there. So what do you recommend?
Exactly.
That people can donate things, that they should feel better about donating things to people who really need them? Is that
exactly
some strategy?
You know, Exactly. One of the things that we like to do is to help people feel good about what's happening with their things, whether they get money for it or not. And, you know, having something gone is worth a lot of money, whether you get money for it or not. Because if it's not gone, you're going to have to pay to get it gone. So what we try and do is work with our clients to identify charities. And some of our clients would rather donate than get pennies on the dollar. And so, you know, identifying charities that could use, you know, like you just said, it's a great option. People feel good about that.
Is there any other advice that you have for people? What about Craigslist or those kinds of, some neighborhoods even have neighborhood listservs, for example, where people can pass around information like that. Does that work? And are there some things that tend to be perhaps more desirable on something like a Craigslist than going to, say, a consignment store or something like that?
Exactly. If someone has a piano, really, the only place to sell it is Craigslist, in my opinion. It's just a great way for you to get it on the market, have people identify and see it. So there are certain things that do better on Craigslist than some of the other options that are out there. But one of my tips for people is, you know, start early, start now, you know, getting rid of those items that you don't want, because the longer you have make decisions or to sell something, the better outcome you're going to have. If you're doing this in a short time frame, you need to sort of employ some other strategies.
Before we let you go, do you mind if I ask, how did you get involved in this work? You seem very patient and pleasant, and I'm sure that's a good quality to have in this work. How
Thank
did you,
you
get involved in this?
Well, my background is as a social worker, but my business started when I helped my own parents who were downsizing from a home that they had lived in for over 60 years. And they needed to get rid of a lot of things. And it occurred to me at that time that, you know, they couldn't be the only people in this situation. So I looked online and identified the National Association of Senior Move Managers, where, you know, these are people that help people in transition and have the resources available to help people get rid of their things and feel good about what's happening to those things.
Okay, you know, I'm going to put you on the spot here. What was the hardest thing for your parents to get rid of? Or what would be the hardest thing for you to get rid of?
For my parents, it was a book collection because it was very near and dear to them. My father spent a lifetime in books. And so parting with that was very difficult. And identifying the right resource and the right buyer for his books was really important. So we allowed a lot of time to do that and ultimately found the right resource. I try not to get too attached. I do this for a living, so I try not to get too attached to my things because it's more about who you are and less about what you have.
Yeah.
So
okay.
I try and live by that.
All right. Well, I'm going to take a peek in your shoe closet, and then we'll have another conversation about it. We'll see what
okay.
happens. Kate Grondin is the founder of Home Transition Resource. She joined us from Member Station WGBH in Boston. Thank you.
Thank you.
They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. Today we want to talk about a hot topic among parents that's back in the news. Two female chief executives who are also mothers are creating buzz for their comments about balancing family and career. PepsiCo CEO Indra Nooyi waded into the "Can Women Have It All" debate, proclaiming, "No, we can't." And in a recent interview with NBC's Today Show, General Motors CEO Mary Barra was asked whether she felt she could be a good mother and a good executive at the same time. We called in some of our trusted parenting contributors to weigh in on these stories. With us now are Leslie Morgan Steiner. She's an author and mom of three. Jolene Ivey is a Maryland state lawmaker, recently a candidate for lieutenant governor and a mom of five. And Alicia Montgomery is a supervising editor here at Tell Me More and a mom of one. Thank you, ladies, for joining us.
Hey, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle.
So let's start with PepsiCo CEO's Indra Nooyi. This is what she told David Bradley, owner of the Atlantic Media Company. They were having a conversation at the Aspen Ideas Festival.
You know, you have to cope because you die with guilt. My observation, David, is that the biological clock and the career clock are in total conflict with each other. When you have to have kids, you have to build your career. Just as you're rising to middle management, your kids need you because they're teenagers. And that's the time your husband becomes a teenager too. So he needs you. I'm sorry. They need you too. So what do you do? And as you grow even more, your parents need you because they're aging. So be screwed. I mean, we have no, we cannot have it all. But you know.
So she went on to make some other interesting sort of comments. Well, let me just hear from everybody on this. Leslie, how do you respond to her comments?
Well, I think she's a perfect example of somebody who really does have it all and still has a sense of humor. And I think that the question of whether women can have it all is kind of wonderful and ridiculous at the same time. It's wonderful because it means that we have choices that many of our mothers and grandmothers didn't have, and that's great. And it's a fascinating, crazy time to be a woman in America. But it's a ridiculous question because the only way you can't have it all is if you're too strict about what it all means. And I think that motherhood turns you upside down and inside out, and you have to just kind of go with how crazy it is. And I think that staying home is crazy, and I think that working when you have kids is crazy in a different way. And I think that the solution for me, at least, has really been to love motherhood and to stand up for myself and ask for help and just hug the gorilla whenever possible.
Did she take you anywhere with these comments? I meant to mention that you have an MBA also and had a career as a business person yourself before you decided to devote yourself to writing. Did her comments take you anywhere? Did it change anything for you? Did it inspire you in any way?
It was inspiring because she's a woman at the top of her game. You know, she's so ambitious and she's been so successful, and she's being honest about the incredible pressures on being a daughter, a mother, a wife, and she's doing it with grace and with humor. And so I thought it was incredible. I also love that she's not putting a false front on it. She's not saying it's easy or that it's perfect.
Alicia, I see you nodding. What do you think? How'd you respond to her comments?
Well, I think that it's valuable to have a successful woman actually say that, because I think that if you look at women who are very successful in their careers, you don't get that way by accident. You get there by being a perfectionist, by putting in extra hours, by, you know, building your network and putting in long days. And you can have the expectation that once you have a child, well, you're going to do the same thing. You're going to be perfect at that, too. You're going to be at the top of your class. And children have a way of humbling you in the best way. And you have to make peace with not having perfection. And that can be a tough lesson for a lot of accomplished women.
Jolene, what do you think?
I think that you have to decide what all is. And you can probably have everything if you do it in stages. But I look forward to the day when we can have these discussions with men also about their lives, or stop having them with women about our lives. Because, you know, we're all trying to do the same things and we're all trying to do our best. And no one ever asked my husband how he manages to have it all. You know, it's not even an issue. But for me, people do feel that they can ask me how I'm able to manage, how I can balance things. I don't know that I am. I'm just doing my best, and I hope that men are doing their best, too.
You know, and that leads to the other thing we want. Speaking of that, this idea of what people think they can ask women that they don't ask of men, let's just go to that. Let's just play that clip that we're talking about that got a lot of people's attention. Please don't throw anything at me, because I didn't. I'm just, you know, the messenger here. This is where the Matt Lauer, NBC's Matt Lauer, spoke with Mary Barra, the CEO of General Motors, who's obviously got a lot on her plate, too, with all these recalls and a lot of other issues that have actually gotten her called before Congress. And this is a question that he asked that's been getting some attention here.
You're a mom, I mentioned, two kids. You said in an interview not long ago that your kids said they're going to hold you accountable for one job, and that is being a mom.
Correct.
Given the pressures of this job at General Motors, can you do both well?
You know, I think I can. I have a great team. We're on the right path. We're doing the right things. We're taking accountability. And also, I have a wonderful family, a supportive husband, and I'm pretty proud of my kids the way they're supporting me in this.
So go ahead, Jolene.
I really wish she had just flipped him the bird. I really, really do. He has got a lot of nerve asking her that. And I think that she was way too kind to him to give him a civilized response.
What would you have said?
Well, I think that and there was more to that interview.
That we can put on
right?
the air.
There was more to that interview because he also asked her, and I don't know if you were planning on playing this, but he also asked her about if she'd gotten the job because she's a woman and that she's a mother, and that kind of softens the image for the company at a difficult time. And she rejected that. And she said, no, had nothing to do about it with me getting this job. I'm just the most qualified person. And I wish she had flipped it and said, actually, of course it helped me get this job. And thank God that sometimes being a woman is viewed as a positive thing, and that there are good things about being a woman that helps a company. I wish he had said that. And the part about, you know, your role as a mother, it said, you know what, it's actually not your business and my family's fine. Of course, she's the one who raised it as an issue in the first place in some previous interview, saying what her kids had said to her.
Well, so you're saying he shouldn't have asked. I mean, that's an interesting question because I think that, you know, interviewers often debate what is okay to ask and what isn't okay to ask. But the question I have is, why aren't more men asked that? I mean, why can't men be asked that, how they're balancing
all
this? Oh,
they should be. I really wish, like I said, that either men would be asked the same questions or men or women wouldn't be asked them. That's what makes me crazy. There's such an imbalance to the whole situation.
Did people ask you this? I mentioned you just came off a tough primary season where you're running for lieutenant governor.
Right.
And your husband previously was an elected official. He was a attorney general, the state's attorney in the jurisdiction in which you live.
Right.
And you supported a number of his campaigns over the
years.
So as well as you are yourself a state lawmaker. So do people ask you, so you've seen both sides of it.
Yes.
Do people ask you questions that they don't tend to ask him about how the family's doing in the midst of the campaign?
Absolutely. And the interesting thing to me is a lot of people ask me during this time, how is Glenn handling the switch? How is he handling him being behind the scenes and taking care of the home base while you're out in front? And no one asked me about that ever. But, you know, and I always say, well, he's doing great. You know, he couldn't be better, which was absolutely true. And then they'd say, well, it's your turn. So it was nice that people kind of recognized the switch. But at the same time, I'll be glad when we don't have to recognize the switch. What if it'd been the other way? What if I'd been the one who'd first been an elected official and then my husband later took that stance? Would people be asking him, boy, how's Jolene doing being the one behind the scenes? I don't think they would. I think they expect women to take that spot graciously and to support their husbands.
Leslie, you wanted to say something?
You know, I share the outrage over the questions that were asked, but I think it brings up a really pragmatic issue, is that women in the workforce, we are asked these questions all the time. And in my career, I had, you know, people, interviewers and colleagues ask things like, you know, well, isn't your boyfriend paying for your business school tuition, which I just want to say I paid every penny of it myself. You know, how long, it must be nice to take a maternity leave. It's such a great vacation. You know, you're in a professional setting, you are, comments like this are lobbed at you constantly. And I think that women need to know how to answer them with grace and humor and not let it get under your skin. And it's part of why we need to talk about these issues so that we can share really witty comebacks. Because it happens all the time.
Alicia, you wanted to jump in on this?
Well, I'm torn because I'm wondering if part of why women keep getting asked these questions is nobody does what Jolene said, which is say, my family is my business, and it's not something that's open for comment on the Today Show. And it's really regrettable that what women are sort of forced to do in whatever arena, if you make the choice to stay at home with your children, you are sometimes, you know, in your mom's group, eyes get rolled sometimes. Your schoolmates might say, well, you sure wasted that 4 years of college. If you choose to make a go of your career while you have children at home, then people say, well, you certainly are, you know, a lousy mother, or, you know, your kids, don't your kids feel neglected? Aren't they going to turn out to be, you know, psychologically damaged because you spend all this time at the office? I think that at some point we'll know that we've made progress when women don't feel like they have to apologize for the choices that we make. And we can be, you know, we don't have to be defensive or put on the defensive by people like, you know, Matt Lauer or whomever,
you know,
about those choices.
You know, what's interesting to me is that Indra Nooyi, in that same conversation at the Aspen Ideas Festival with David Bradley, recounted this incident when she found out that she was going to be given this big promotion. She would become president of the company, and she went home, and her mother, who was evidently living with them, asked her to go back out and get some milk. And she'd come home earlier than she normally did, which was around 10 o'clock at night. And she said, well, you know, is my husband home? She said, and her mom says, well, he's tired. And she said, well, you know, she went out and got the milk and then was annoyed about it. And I you know, I listened to that conversation, and I think if a man had told that conversation, she described that as a very gendered thing, like, you're not proud of me because I'm this big, you know, big time executive. And she said, her mother said, you know, leave your crown in the garage. You know, remember when you're here, your wife, your mother, your daughter. If a man had said that, this story would have been recounted as an example of kind of his family bringing him back down to earth. And so what I wonder is, why isn't it similarly seen in this context? I mean, that, you know, hypothetically, let's just say I may have shared with someone in my life at some point, you know, just because you make more money than me doesn't mean you're more important than me. I may have said that to someone. So why wouldn't this be another example of somebody saying, you know what, just because you're this big time executive doesn't mean that that's more important than what's going on in this house. By the way, you know, you sell soda and chips.
You know, so, I saw that story because I thought that was a great story also. But it was her mother, who's of a different generation, telling her what her place is. If her husband, who's of her generation, had told her what her place is, well, that would have been grounds for divorce, or at least
axe murder. Similarly, she said in the same conversation, she said her husband has sometimes said to her, look, this is your order of priorities. It's PepsiCo, 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 your kids, your mom, then me. Right. And she said, be lucky you're on the list. Be glad you're on the list.
Right.
If a man had said that to a woman, would you think it was funny?
Probably not. But I have to give her a lot of credit for telling him that at least he's on the list. So, you know,
but
I guess
not?
Because women have not even been on the list for so many generations, it's nice finally when a woman has got the ability to come with a nice sharp comeback, even if it's not right.
To that end, though, I was going to, and if you're just joining us, we're having our weekly parenting conversation. We're talking about some hot topics that recently were brought up by two women executives at the top of their game, giving interviews and talking about their lives. We're speaking with Leslie Morgan Steiner, Jolene Ivey, and Alicia Montgomery, all here in our Washington, D.C. studios. All of our regulars, except we're missing a couple, but glad that you all are here. Well, so should we be talking about this at all? I mean, I'm going to put you on the spot now, because is this a mistake that we're even having this conversation, Leslie?
No, of course we should be talking about it. And, you know, 10 years ago when I was writing my book, Mommy Wars, women weren't talking about this, and men sure weren't talking about it. So I think it's great to talk about it. And I think that the issues of how hard it is to combine work and family aren't real issues for you until you actually have your first child. And I think we should be talking about it endlessly. It's a fascinating time to be a woman in this country, and we should all be digging into it. And there are lots of different opinions about it, and I think everybody should be a part of the conversation. So I think it's great to talk about it.
Alicia, what do you think?
I think that yes, we should be having the conversation, and part of what gets left out of the conversation is you don't have it all by yourself. You know, all these women who are very accomplished, you have good childcare, so you don't have to worry during the day about whether your kid's getting fed and getting attention. You have, and you know, I know that I have a very supportive workplace with coworkers who are very understanding if I have to have an obligation with my child. I've got a great extended family who, you know, picks up slack, does babysitting, gives me referrals to great doctors, great sitters, all this sort of thing. And I think that what gets disappeared in the conversation is how necessary those networks are.
Do you have a different perspective on this? As Alicia, as a single mom, do you feel, is there anything that was said here in that you want to sort of frame differently as a single mom?
Well, I think that, you know, as a single mom, you're sort of in the forefront of having people second guess your choices as a mom. You know, everybody, I think that we get sort of an extra dose of the guy at the supermarket or the person, you know, waiting for you in a carpool, or, you know, folks sometimes, you know, in your neighborhood, it, kind of second guessing your choices. But I think that all moms understand what it's like to have people feel free to sort of call out the most intimate relationships of your life and try to give you a grade on them on the Today Show or on the nightly news.
Jolene, anything you want to add as a person who's had to parent in public, as a public
right.
official, as a spouse of a public official, who's you've had to parent in public in a way that most of us don't? Any advice you want to share on that?
Well, I mean, as far as my kids go and being in public, when we're actually in public, they know they better behave. So, but I really think about the women like Alicia or others, maybe not doing as well in their careers, they don't always have all those choices we're talking about. So it's great for us to be able to sit here and talk about what choices that you've made. A lot of people don't have choices. I mean, they have to go to a job they might not like, that might not be supportive, and they might not have very much support at home. You know, so when I think about single moms with those kind of struggles, I really feel for them.
Briefly, final thought from you, Leslie?
You know, one thing we haven't talked about is how you explain all this to your children. And I think it's important to always remember, as a mom, you know, the kids don't see it necessarily the way that you do, and they don't see the big picture. So I try to tell my kids all the time how much I love being their mom, even when it's hard and even when it's crazy. I just try to let them know that I'm a happy mom, because I think that that's the most important thing to them.
Leslie Morgensteiner is an author and a mom of three. Jolene Ivey is a Maryland state lawmaker, recent candidate for lieutenant governor, and a mom of five. Alicia Montgomery is a supervising editor here at Tell Me More and a mom of one. And no, I did not make her make those supportive comments about the workplace. I just want to be clear, everybody knows her choice. They were all here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you all so much.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle.